Well, from the beginning, the campaign was nationwide. I mean, it did start in London, but it very quickly took root in the major cities in nations of the United Kingdom, so Edinburgh and Dublin and Belfast, as well as the major provincial cities in England, all had suffrage societies. And in the 19th century, some of the societies dwindled over the years, but then would rise again when some enterprising woman came along and took them in hand. But generally, there was a presence in all the cities, and they would hold big public meetings. And in fact, in the run-up to the 1884 Reform Act, there were a whole succession of what were called monster demonstrations. I mean, these were grand demonstrations where they had would fill a hall filling with thousands of people and then have overflow rooms. I mean, it was a very popular campaign. So it's a mistake to think that nothing much happened outside London in the 19th century. And as well as that, there were women travelling round the country speaking at all manner of meetings. I mean, not only in these large halls, but also in village halls and in marketplaces and then even in cottages on open heaths to drum up interest from all classes of people. It wasn't, although it was only going to be women who had the property, who could meet the property qualification, who would actually get the vote, the campaigners were very keen to get backing from women who wouldn't at that time be qualified. But it was a real campaign of solidarity to get women interested in the political situation, I think. And then as the campaign took a different direction in the early 20th century, with the founding of the WSPU, they set up branches in many cities around England and Scotland, not so much in Ireland, but in England and Scotland. And again, they depended on the force of organisers who were sent there. On the whole, the WSPU tended to send organisers who weren't necessarily from the local area to organise meetings over quite a long period of time. They might be based for a year or so in the same city, but they had many of them had a strong local following. And Mrs. Pankhurst, of course, and Christabel would be heralded to coming into town to hold a meeting, and there would be a great deal of publicity. We still see photographs still available, you can find, of some of these meetings, and you'll see speakers in the marketplace, for instance, just surrounded by a sea of people, mainly men, actually, quite often. But there was always so much interest in the suffrage campaign. And as a breakaway from the Women's Social and Political Union, in 1907, one group led by a woman called Mrs. Charlotte Despard set up a separate organisation, the Women's Freedom League, and they're usually also referred to as suffragettes. But they weren't militant in quite the same way as the WSPU. They weren't violent, or at least didn't intend to be violent. They preferred peaceful methods of civil protest. Picketing Parliament was one, and they organised they were the first organisers of the boycott of the 1911 census. The WSPU then took up the idea, but it had actually originated from the Women's Freedom League. And they had societies in many of the cities, particularly in England. And they were, perhaps, if one was thinking it from left to right, as it were, they were slightly more left-wing than the WSPU. They were tended to favour socialism a bit more, and many of them were keen vegetarians. This was all part of their ethos of the time. So the campaign in the 20th century then was totally nationwide, really, from Land's End to Johnny Groats. There were suffrage societies. I mean, there was a suffrage society certainly in Wick, as close as you get perhaps to Johnny Groats. And the NUWSS, in order to show how widespread their influence was, in 1913 they organised what they called the pilgrimage, by which members of the societies walked from various points around Britain to London. So from Land's End there was a group, and then from Kent there was a group, and from Carlisle, and then there was a northeasterly group as well. So they all converged in a monster rally in Hyde Park in July 1913, and that demonstrated just how widespread their membership was. By this time, they vastly outnumbered the WSPU in actual membership, although the WSPU was still grabbing the headlines. And by 1913, they were grabbing the headlines because violence had really taken off, and by now they were setting bombs and setting fire to houses or empty buildings, churches, railway stations. And this was supposedly to terrorise, I suppose, the government into giving women the vote, but it certainly didn't have that effect. It did mean that many more WSPU members were arrested, and when they were arrested now and went into prison, they often went on hunger strike in an attempt to get early release. And originally, at the beginning of the first hunger strikes, they would be released, but the government then decided that rather than releasing them, they would forcibly feed them, which was an appalling treatment when the women were resisting having the tubes put down their throats in order for liquid nutrition, so-called, to be poured down. And many of the women were then really taken very ill and had to be released anyway. And it gave the Liberal government an awful reputation, and it also gave the WSPU a very good reason to protest even more violently against the government. And when the women were released, having been on hunger strike, they were supposed to return to prison after a few days when they'd recovered their strength, but needless to say, many of them didn't. And the act under which they were released was known colloquially as the Cat and Mouse Act, and so the women who were on the run, as it were known as the mice. And now, on the run and with really no restraints, the usual restraints of society, they often committed even more extensive and more violent acts of arson than they had done before, and some of them were on the run for several months at a time. And the trail of arson can now be tracked. By the time that the war broke out in August 1914, there were quite a few WSPU prisoners in prison being forcibly fed, because the government had managed to use their technique so that they didn't actually make the women so ill as they were being fed, or perhaps the women had just given up resisting quite so much. And it was quite surprising the appalling number of times that women had been forcibly fed before they were released under an amnesty at the outbreak of war.